actually happens.
As a point of contrast, if the Democrats had nominated Charlie Sheen and the only alternative to that was Ted Cruz, whom I loathe, my vote has to go to Ted Cruz. I can't even protest by not voting. I have to vote for Ted Cruz in order to stop Charlie Sheen from having the nuclear codes.
You voted for Donald Trump. You voted for people like me to be put in camps like Auschwitz. You voted for that!
What happened?
Have you heard him say anything positive? Have you heard him just say like, what are the problems in America? Hillary can make a case because she has said something that happened.
Dr. Craig, was that a rip-roaring, barn-burner election?
Just unbelievable, Kevin, and the result was so unexpected. It just bewildered and baffled the pundits and commentators as these results began to come in, and you could see the shock on their faces. I remember one saying, "Why, we could wake up tomorrow and find Donald Trump to be president of the United States." He just couldn't believe it. It was truly historic.
And the fact that the polls tended to show the opposite of the results, that makes me wonder about polling.
It really does raise questions. I think the best spin that could be put on it would be that we need to remember these polls are simply opinion polls, and it could very well be that the polls were accurate in registering the opinions of those surveyed, but that it didn't actually measure voter turnout, and therefore the polls could have been accurate in terms of the opinions they registered, but they didn't accurately predict what the voters who actually turned out would do.
People have, in the evangelical community in particular, and conservative people, have talked about how important this election was. In fact, it got to the point that I think we were worrying ourselves to death. This really was the sky is falling. This really is crucial. And Bill, was that warranted? I mean, what are the main things? I mean, well, the main thing I think that you mentioned was Supreme Court nominee.
Yes, and that certainly is huge, though I'm inclined to think that the most important election was actually the 2008 election in which Obama beat John McCain. When you think of the implications of that election for turmoil in the Middle East, chaos in Iraq, Libya, Syria, you think of the Supreme Court, you think of health care in the United States, that election seemed to me to be truly the turning point. And the question will be whether or not this also historic election will reverse some of those trends. So I don't want to minimize the importance of this election by any means, but we don't need to engage in hyperbole by saying it's the most important election of our lifetime. The choice of President Obama over John McCain was huge as well.
You mentioned in your Defenders class, sometimes we have to take the lesser of two evils, and that's appropriate. Some people kind of have trouble with that. They're going to either not vote or they're going to write in their uncle, you know, which I heard about people doing.
Yeah, I think that there is a kind of immaturity among some people about moral decision-making where they think that moral decision-making is a matter of choosing between the good alternative and the bad alternative. And that's a very naive, almost childish view of moral decision-making. We are frequently confronted with moral choices in which we have no good alternatives. Or alternatively, we have two good alternatives to choose from, and you have to then choose between two goods. But sometimes you have to choose between two bads. Intro courses in philosophy or ethics major on this point by presenting moral dilemmas to clarify students' values. For example, a textbook illustration is the runaway streetcar example, where if you do not throw the switch, the streetcar will hit and kill a man working on the tracks. But if you do throw the switch, then the streetcar will kill five people who are on the track. So which choice do you make? You don't have a good choice in a case like that. There are two bad outcomes, and you have to choose the lesser of two evils. I think the most poignant illustration of this point, Kevin, is Sophie's Choice, where the woman, the young mother, is presented by the Nazi soldiers with a choice as to which of her children will be sent to the death camp and which one she can keep alive. And if she refuses to choose one of her two children, then both will be sent to the death camps. Well, in a case like this, this poor mother had no good choice. She had to choose the lesser of two evils and pick one of her two children to be exterminated. It's just horrible. Well, similarly, in a case like this, we didn't have two good candidates to choose from. Both were flawed in multiple ways, and the outcomes were flawed in multiple ways. And yet, that doesn't exempt you from having to make a decision in a case like this, and you choose the lesser of two evils. Which outcome would be better for the United States of America than the other? And I think that, as you've already indicated, the implications for the Supreme Court are just huge in this case. We were choosing which president would be appointing not only the replacement for the late Antonin Scalia, but perhaps for other justices as well, that could radically affect the direction of the Supreme Court for a generation to come.
There are no perfect candidates. These two particular candidates, according to so many, but they really did have some glaring high-profile problems. Donald Trump wasn't exactly aligned with evangelicals, conservative Christians, and so on, and his well-known boisterous behavior. But ironically, Bill, it seemed that in choosing the lesser of the two evils, he is more in line with preserving a lot of the heritages of our country, the Judeo-Christian heritage. Now, isn't that ironic? Because as compassionate and passionate as Hillary was about so many social causes, she would have, according to most evangelicals, taken us further away from our Judeo-Christian heritage, a trend started by the Obama administration, further away from that, and we wanted to retain that.
Well, I think the trend started much earlier, way back in 1973 with Roe versus Wade, where the state laws regulating abortion were all overthrown because the court found somehow in the Constitution the right to abortion on demand. And now, more recently, five lawyers appointed to the Supreme Court have determined that two men can marry each other, or two women can marry each other, that same-sex marriage is a right somehow found in the Constitution. And lest anyone think that these Supreme Court battles are over and done with, what is looming on the horizon now, Kevin, is a threat to religious liberty that is extremely significant. And I want to just refer here to a report from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights entitled Peaceful Coexistence, Reconciling Non-Discrimination Principles with Civil Liberties. And what this commission has said is that exemptions based upon religious conscience are illegitimate, that these are really concealed forms of discrimination and should not be allowed. Let me just quote from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. They state, religious exemptions to the protections of civil rights based upon classifications such as race, color, national origin, sex, disability status, sexual orientation, and gender identity, when they are permissible, significantly infringe upon these civil rights. In other words, if this commission's recommendations were to be followed, that would mean that Christian churches, Christian charities and organizations would not be exempt from having to hire people irregardless of their gender orientation, their religious beliefs, so that you could be forced as a church to hire a Muslim as your youth pastor. Because if you don't, you're guilty of religious discrimination. Mm. Or to hire a practicing homosexual as your youth minister, because if you don't, you're guilty of discrimination. This is going to be coming before the courts in the future. And therefore, it is just critical that we have a Supreme Court that will protect the free exercise clause in the Bill of Rights that would not force religious organizations to hire people who are fundamentally at odds with their religious beliefs.
We may have to do an entire podcast on this because there's so much to this.
I just want to underline here the importance of these Supreme Court appointments. That's all, because this is the issue looming now that is going to come before the court eventually.
Yes, and the chairman of this report, Martin R. Castro, led his opinion with this statement: "The government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion," the John Adams quotation. Hmm. And that's how he led that. We can get into that later. And technically, you know, that's true.
Right.
A difference between our founding and the heritage that we've, the Judeo-Christian heritage that's undergirded it. But it's interesting that that's how he led it. And I want to say one more thing about it, Bill, and get your opinion on the fact that he says religious freedom can just remain code words for homophobia, mm-hmm. Islamophobia, Christian supremacy, or any form of intolerance.
Exactly.
I still have trouble with phobia. A phobia is a clinical disorder. So if you have religious conviction against a certain behavior, you have a clinical disorder. So that's gotten so entrenched in our lexicon that it's even in this report from our government.
Yes, shocking, isn't it, that it would be part of this report from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. It's really astonishing.
Bill, as a debater, you've got to say something about the debates.
Well, I am not a big fan of these presidential debates. They're not genuine debates. They're more like Q&A times or interviews. And sadly, the winner of these debates seems to be determined by who has the best zinger or who expresses your views most clearly. There's very rarely a substantive exchange of ideas in these debates. It's mainly mudslinging and rhetoric. Now, having said that, I did think that the third debate between Trump and Clinton was very substantive. I don't think in any presidential debate have we seen more clearly laid out the policy differences between the one candidate and the other. So I did think that the third debate was profitable in simply clearly laying out the alternatives. I didn't think there was a winner and a loser of the debate. The winner was the American public, who could see very, very clearly the differences between the two candidates that we had to choose from.
I noticed the next day after each debate, the press counted the interruptions. Who interrupted who and how many interruptions were. There were a lot of interruptions in these debates.
Oh.
And Bill, I've...
Especially, I just interrupted you. the Tim Kaine debate with Michael Pence. I mean, Kaine was just on... He was like being on electric therapy, being shocked. He was just constantly interrupting.
Oh. Well, that reminds me of a certain debate you had with a certain Dr. Krause.
Yeah, I know, it's true.
This is something new. I don't know of a past presidential debate that had interruptions like this. They've always been very civil.
Yeah.
So this doesn't need to be a trend, Bill, or what, are we going to be reduced to shouting matches?
I think that this is a result of the kind of discourse that goes on talk radio and television interviews. So often in these interview programs on television, the two people being interviewed try to talk over each other. And you just hear a cacophony of words without any clear understanding, and the moderators are so weak. I blame the moderators to a great extent. They're so weak that they cannot control the dialogue, and so you get both people talking at the same time, constant interruptions, and one would hope for more civil discourse, Kevin, I think, in these presidential debates.
This is nothing new. For the last 15 or 20 years, university administrations have been telling students who come to shout down a speaker, said, if you can do that to them, that can be done to you. And do you want to go that road? Mm. Because then you're back to might makes right.
Yeah.
And that's a fallacy. But I think that perhaps that has calmed down a little bit on college campuses, but there was concern for a while of shouting down, going to a lecture to shout them down.
Yeah. So
as we wrap up, Bill, let's talk about now that this election is over. A lot of people are breathing a big sigh of relief. A lot of people are very upset. What are your thoughts on where we go from here?
I think where we go from here is that we really hold Donald Trump accountable for the promises that he's made, particularly with regard to these Supreme Court appointments. Since we've got a Republican Senate and a Republican House, there's going to be a check upon any excesses that Trump might try to exercise. I don't trust Donald Trump. I don't think that we just accept carte blanche that what he said he would do, he will do. He needs to be held accountable. And so this is a call for vigilance on the part of our House and Senate to make sure that he keeps his promises and does what he was elected to do and not try to go off the reservation.
Shattered pieces, frayed and torn, scattered pieces.